It goes without saying that anything that happens in the United States has an enormous impact on the rest of the world, last election, for example, and conversely, that's important to remember. What happens in the rest of the world has cannot fail to have an important, in fact, decisive, crucial, often, impact in the United States. And that happens in several ways. For one thing, it sets constraints on what even the most powerful state can do. But in a more significant way, what happens elsewhere, like here, influences the domestic component of what the New York Times ruefully described as the second superpower, namely world public opinion, after the enormous protests against the right before the Iraq invasion. And those protests were a critically important historical event. We should not forget why. First of all, their scale was quite unprecedented, but also it was the first time in hundreds of years of the history of Europe and its North American offshoots that a war was protested, and in fact massively protested, before it was officially launched. And that's a historic event, and it tells us a lot about where we've come, and should be encouraging, not depressing. Take, say, by comparison, the war, what's called the Vietnam War, actually the war against South Vietnam, that was launched by John F. Kennedy in 1962. It was brutal and barbaric from the outset. Began with bombing of unprotected civilian targets, chemical warfare to destroy food crops so as to starve out the civilian support for the indigenous resistance, programs to drive millions of people to virtual concentration camps or urban slums to eliminate the popular base for the resistance. By the time protests reached the substantial scale, 67, the highly respected and quite hawkish Vietnam specialist and military historian Bernard Fall wondered, quoting him, whether Vietnam as a cultural and historic entity would escape extinction as the countryside literally dies under the blows of the largest military machine ever unleashed on an area of this size. It was particularly South Vietnam, which was always the main target of the U.S. assault. And when protest finally did develop, many years too late, it was mostly directed against the peripheral crimes, the extension of the war to the north and the rest of Indochina. These were terrible crimes, but lesser ones. And it's quite important to remember how much the world has changed since then through deeply committed popular struggle. It's far too late in developing, but ultimately it was effective. The most interesting part of the Pentagon Papers, which is rarely mentioned for good reasons, is the last section. Pentagon Papers ends middle of 1968, and as many of you will remember, or maybe know if you're too young to remember, January 68 was the Tet Offensive, which convinced corporate elite in the United States that the war just wasn't worth it. And the U.S. had won many of its objectives. It had destroyed any serious hope of independent, successful development in Vietnam, which was its main purpose, as in many other cases. And it was just becoming too costly for the United States, too costly because of the rising anti-war movement, which was compelling the president to fight what was called a guns and butter war. Couldn't declare a national mobilization, which probably would have been good for the economy the way it was during the Second World War, but had to kind of buy the population off because there were just too much disruption. And it was just becoming too costly. That was the Tet Offensive, the Pentagon Papers, you know, kind of record of the internal Pentagon history that Dan Ellsberg released. It ends a couple of months after that. And it turns out that right after the Tet Offensive, the president wanted to send 200,000 more troops to South Vietnam, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff objected. They didn't want to do it, and they refused. And the reason they said is that they would need those troops for civil disorder control in the United States because of the rising protests among women, young people, minorities, in fact, a large part of the population. So it was just too dangerous to send more troops to Indochina. That continued and grew by over the next 10 years. You know, elite groups thought they had it under control. When Ronald Reagan came into office, he tried to duplicate what John F. Kennedy had done in South Vietnam 20 years earlier. In fact, Reagan probably didn't know what was going on, but his advisors, his planners, just point by point duplicated it. This is 1981, and the target then was Central America under what was called, incidentally, a war against terror. Was declared in 1981, not in 2001. They had to back off because there was just too much spontaneous protest from church groups, from by then and all over the mainstream of the country, not just young people and so on. So they backed off and they turned to what was called clandestine war. Clandestine war is a technical term that means a war that everybody knows about except the population of the United States. And they don't know it for a good reason, which some people have something to answer for about. So the Reagan administration fought this clandestine war with a huge international terror network. So the cover war on terror, Orwell would have appreciated. That was terrible enough. A couple hundred thousand people were killed, four countries devastated. But it wasn't B-52s, which are much worse. And it wasn't mass murder operations, which happened to be peaking in 1969, at the time when John Kerry was deep in the Mekong Delta in the south, which by then had been largely devastated. The popular reaction to even the clandestine war, which, as it was called, also broke new ground in history, another historically unprecedented development. That was the origin of the solidarity movements for Central America, which were coming right out of the mainstream. Thousands, in fact, tens of thousands of people from the United States actually went to help the victims. That had never happened in the history of European imperialism or its North American offshoots. And by now, they're all over the world. That's, again, something entirely new in Western history and another testimony to the success of these movements, of which there are many. And the state managers are well aware of it. When a new president comes in, first thing he does, has done, is an intelligence assessment. The intelligence community, as it's called, gives an assessment of the world situation. And George Bush, number one, he did it too. So in 1989, there was an assessment of the world situation, and a piece of it leaked. Somebody, usually we don't hear about these things for like 40 years, if ever. But a little part of it leaked and was published. It's kind of hushed up. And it was an interesting part. Somebody obviously in the Pentagon or CIA or somewhere didn't like it and leaked it to the press. It was a discussion of the kinds of wars that the U.S. would be fighting, wars against what it called much weaker enemies. Those are the only kind of wars you fight, if you have any sense. Wars against much weaker enemies. It said, in the case of such wars, the United States would have to win them rapidly and decisively because there simply is no political support for anything more than that. It's not like the 60s when you could go on for years and years with no protest and destroy a country before it significantly develops. Well, that's significant. I mean, the world is a pretty awful place, and you can look at it and get pretty depressed, but it's far better than it was yesterday. And that's not only with regard to the unwillingness to tolerate aggression, but also in innumerable other ways, many of which we now just take for granted, which is good. We should take it for granted. But we should also remember that not many years ago it wasn't like that. There are very important lessons, and they should always be foremost in our mind. If we had a little more time, I'd intended to say a couple of words about Canada's role in the Indochina Wars, which is pretty interesting, but I'll skip that. I'll say I'm being polite. But you should know about it if you don't already. It's pretty ugly. Well, without forgetting the very significant progress towards more civilized societies, which has taken place in the past years, and crucially the reasons for it, namely popular engagement and struggle, let's focus nevertheless on the present and on the topic that was suggested for this evening, the notions of imperial sovereignty that are now being crafted. It's not surprising that as the population becomes more civilized, power systems become more extreme in their efforts to control the great beast, as the founding fathers of U.S. society called the people, the hated and feared people. The conceptions of popular sovereignty that are being crafted by the radical statist reactionaries of the Bush administration are in fact so extreme that they've drawn unprecedented criticism in the most sober and respected establishment circles. Actually, it's pretty helpful to people like me. Instead of quoting, you know, sort of far out types, you can quote the most respectable mainstream journals, and they're saying more, you know, stronger things than you might have said yourself. The administration's ideas of presidential sovereignty were transmitted to the president by the newly appointed attorney general, Alberto Gonzalez. At that time, he was the president's counsel, and he's depicted now as a moderate in the press. His views on this are discussed by the very respected constitutional law professor, Sanford Levinson, in the current issue of the Journal of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. You can't get more respectable than that. Levinson writes that the conception being crafted by the Justice Department, transmitted by Gonzalez, is based on the principle that, quoting, there exists no norm that is applicable to chaos. And that quote, as Levinson comments, is from Carl Schmitt, who was the leading German philosopher of law during the Nazi period. Levinson describes him as the true eminence grise of the Bush administration. The administration, advised by Gonzalez, has, quoting Levinson, has articulated a view of presidential authority that is all too close to the power that Schmitt was willing to accord his own Führer. One rarely hears words like that from the heart of the establishment. The same issue of that super respectable journal has an article by two leading strategic analysts on what's called the transformation of the military. It's another component of the new doctrines of imperial sovereignty that are being crafted. That's the rapid expansion of offensive weaponry, including the militarization of space, in this case joined apparently by Canada, and other measures that are designed to place the entire world at risk of instant annihilation. And these have elicited the anticipated reactions by potential targets, Russia and China, who are developing their own offensive weaponry in order to overwhelm it. These two analysts conclude that the U.S. programs may lead to, in their words, ultimate doom. And they express their hope that a coalition of peace-loving nations will coalesce as a counter to U.S. Militarism and aggressiveness, a coalition led by China. Now, we've come to a pretty pass when such sentiments are voiced in sober and respectable circles, which aren't given to hyperbole, and when their faith in U.S. democracy is so slight that they look to China to save us from marching towards ultimate doom. And it's up to the second superpower to decide whether that contempt for the great beast is warranted. Well, going back to Gonzalez, the president's counsel then, he transmitted to the president the conclusion of the Justice Department that the president has the authority to rescind the Geneva Conventions. It's the supreme law of the land under the U.S. Constitution, and the foundation of modern international humanitarian law. And Gonzalez advised the president that this would be a good idea. In his words, it substantially reduces the threat of domestic criminal prosecution of administration officials under the War Crimes Act of 1996, which carries the death penalty for grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions. So he better rescind them quickly. Well, we can see right on today's front pages why the Justice Department was right to be concerned that the president and his advisors might be subject to the death penalty under the laws passed by the Republican Congress in 1996. And, of course, under the principles of Nuremberg, if anyone took them seriously. 2 weeks ago, on the front page of the New York Times, prominently displayed, was a picture of Fallujah General Hospital. The accompanying story said, patients and hospital employees were rushed out of rooms by armed soldiers and ordered to sit or lie on the floor while troops tied their hands behind their backs. And that's what the picture shows, armed soldiers standing over people lying, patients and doctors lying on the floor with their hands tied behind their backs. And that's described in the stories, in the front page stories, an important achievement. Quote, New York Times, it shut down a propaganda weapon for the militants. Fallujah General Hospital had been producing a stream of reports of civilian casualties, and these inflated figures, I mean inflated because our leader so declares, were inflaming opinion throughout the country and the region, driving up the political costs of the conflict. Incidentally, the word conflict is by now a common euphemism for U.S. aggression, as when we read on the same front pages that the U.S. must now rebuild what the conflict just destroyed. A conflict has no agent. It's kind of like a hurricane. It happens, and then we have to come in and rebuild it. Well, let's go back to the picture and the story about the closing of the propaganda weapon, the main hospital. There are some relevant documents, including the Geneva Conventions. So here's a principle of the Geneva Conventions. Fixed establishments and mobile medical units of the medical service may in no circumstances be attacked and shall at all times be respected and protected by parties to the conflict. So page one of the world's leading newspaper is cheerfully depicting war crimes for which the political leadership could be sentenced to death under U.S. law. No wonder that the Attorney General warned the president, as his counsel, that he should use the constitutional authority that the Justice Department concocted to rescind the supreme law of the land, adopting the concept of presidential sovereignty devised by Hitler's primary legal advisor, the true eminence grise of the Bush administration, according to a distinguished conservative authority on constitutional law, writing in perhaps the most respectable and sober journal in the country. Well, the world's greatest newspaper also tells us, quoted, that the U.S. military achieved nearly all their objectives in Fallujah well ahead of schedule, leaving much of the city in smoking ruins. But it was not, I'm quoting it, but it was not a complete success. Why? There was little evidence of dead pack rats in their warrens or the streets. Now, those are their words, not mine. They did find a body of a dead woman, though it's not known whether she was an Iraqi or a foreigner. That's the only question that's raised, and apparently the only one that comes to mind. This is all right in the front pages of the world's greatest newspaper. The front page account also quotes a Marine commander who says, it ought to go down in the history books. Perhaps it should. If so, we know very well on what page of history it'll go down and who will be right beside it, along with those who praise it or, for that matter, even tolerate it. One might at least mention the counterparts that immediately come to mind, like, for example, the Russian destruction of Grozny 10 years ago. It's a city of about the same size. Or Srebrenica, which is almost universally described as genocide in the West. In that case, as we know in detail from an extensive Dutch government report and other sources, this Muslim enclave in Serb territory, which was very lightly protected, was being used as a base for attacks against Serb villages. And when the anticipated reaction took place, it was horrendous. The Serbs drove out all but military age men and then moved in to kill them. Well, that's familiar. It's Fallujah, basically, but there are some differences. Women and children were not bombed out of Srebrenica, as in the Fallujah case, but they were trucked out. And there will be no extensive efforts, we can be sure of that, to exhume the last possible corpse of the pack rats and their warrens in Fallujah. And there are other differences which are arguably unfair to the Serbs. Well, it could be argued that all this is irrelevant. The Nuremberg Tribunal, spelling out the UN Charter, declared that, quoting it, initiation of a war of aggression is the supreme international crime, differing only from other war crimes in that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole, hence the war crimes in Fallujah, Abu Ghraib, and so on. Those judged to have played any role in the supreme crime, for example, the German foreign minister, were sentenced to death by hanging, and the Tokyo Tribunal was far more severe. That is an important book on this topic. If you haven't read it, you should, by the Canadian international lawyer Michael Mandel, who reviews in, unfortunately, convincing detail how the powerful have become self-immunized from international law. In fact, the Nuremberg Tribunal itself established this principle of self-immunity. To bring the Nazi criminals to justice, it was necessary to devise definitions of war crime and crime against humanity that hadn't existed precisely in international law. And how this was done is explained candidly by Telford Taylor, who was the chief counsel for the prosecution at Nuremberg and a distinguished international lawyer and historian. So I'll quote him. Since both sides in World War II had played the terrible game of urban destruction, the Allies far more successfully, there was no basis for criminal charges against Germans or Japanese, and in fact, no such charges were brought. Aerial bombardment had been used so extensively and ruthlessly on the Allied side as well as the Axis side that neither at Nuremberg nor Tokyo was the issue made a part of the trials. So in other words, it goes on like this, the operative definition of crime is crime that you committed and we did not. And to underscore that fact, Nazi war criminals were absolved if the defense could show that their U.S. counterparts carried out the same crimes. Taylor concludes from this that to punish the foe, especially the vanquished foe, for conduct in which the enforcer nation has engaged would be so grossly inequitable as to discredit the laws themselves, which is correct, but the operative definition also discredits the laws themselves, along with all subsequent tribunals, which follow the same principle. Taylor provides this background as part of his explanation of why U.S. bombing in Vietnam was not a war crime, and his argument is plausible, further discrediting the laws themselves. Some of the subsequent tribunals are discredited in perhaps even more extreme ways, such as the Yugoslavia versus NATO case, which is now being adjudicated by the International Court of Justice, World Court. The U.S. was excused, correctly, on the basis of the argument that it is not subject to the jurisdiction of the court in this case. The reason is that when the United States signed the Genocide Convention, which is at issue here, the U.S. finally did sign it after 40 years, it signed it with a reservation saying that it is inapplicable to the United States. And the rules of the World Court say that they can only deal with something if both sides are subjected to its jurisdiction. Now, there was an outraged comment on the efforts of the Justice Department lawyers to demonstrate that the president has the right to authorize torture, a comment by the dean of Yale Law School, Howard Koh, and he said that the notion that the president has the constitutional power to permit torture is like saying that he has the constitutional power to commit genocide. Well, the president's legal advisors, like the new attorney general, should have little difficulty arguing that the president indeed does have that power if the second superpower, us, permits him to exercise it. Let's look at the pretext for the U.S.-British aggression in Iraq, the supreme international crime that encompasses everything that follows. The pretext was the right of what's called anticipatory self-defense. Now it's sometimes called preemptive war, in a radical perversion of that concept. This right of anticipatory self-defense was proclaimed officially in the Bush administration National Security Strategy of September 2002, which declared Washington's right to resort to force to eliminate any potential challenge to its global dominance, any potential threat, if you like. The National Security Strategy was very widely criticized among the foreign policy elite right away. There was an article within weeks in the main establishment journal, Foreign Affairs, which warned that what it called the new imperial grand strategy could be very dangerous for the United States. And the criticism continued, again at a completely unprecedented level, right in the core of the mainstream, but on very narrow grounds. It was not that the doctrine was wrong, but rather its style and manner of implementation. Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, she summed up the criticism pretty accurately, also in Foreign Affairs, it's, you know, main establishment journal. She pointed out that every president has such a doctrine, but keeps it in his back pocket. And it's simply foolish to smash people in the face with it and to implement it in a manner that's going to infuriate even allies. That's threatening to U.S. interests and therefore wrong. Albright knew, of course, that Clinton had a similar doctrine. The Clinton doctrine, I'll quote it, advocated unilateral use of military power to defend vital interests, such as ensuring uninhibited access to key markets, energy supplies, and strategic resources. That's without even the pretexts that Bush and Blair devised. You take it literally, the Clinton doctrine is more expansive than Bush's national security strategy. But unlike the Bush strategy, the more expansive Clinton doctrine was barely even reported. In fact, I'm not sure it was reported at all, and not criticized. And the reason is it was presented with the right style and implemented less brazenly. That's the way you should do it if you're looking for a career in diplomacy. Henry Kissinger described the Bush doctrine as, in his words, revolutionary. He pointed out that it undermines the 17th Westphalian system of international order and sovereignty, and of course he didn't even bother mentioning it. It undermines the UN Charter and current international law. Kissinger approved of the doctrine, but with reservations, the usual reservations about style and tactics, and with a crucial qualification. He said, it cannot be a universal principle available to every nation. Rather, the right of aggression must be reserved to the United States, perhaps delegated to chosen clients. So we must forcefully reject the principle of universality, the principle that we apply to ourselves, the same standards we apply to others, more stringent ones if we're serious. Bush and Blair, who we're told read the Gospels religiously all the time, must know the famous definition of the hypocrite in the Gospels, repeated a couple of times, but maybe it didn't get from the eyes to what lies behind or whatever. And Kissinger, I think, is to be praised, as often, for his honesty in very forthrightly articulating the prevailing doctrines which are usually concealed in professions of virtuous intent and tortured legalisms. And Kissinger also understands his educated audience. As he doubtless expected, there was no reaction. Well, his understanding of his audience was illustrated again rather dramatically just a couple of months ago, last May. Last May, I don't know if it was reported here, some Kissinger-Nixon tapes were released over Kissinger's strong objections. And there was a report in the world's leading journal, New York Times. The report mentioned in passing the orders to bomb Cambodia that Kissinger transmitted from Nixon to the military commanders. In his word, a massive bombing campaign in Cambodia, anything that flies on anything that moves. You get that? Anything that flies on anything that moves. Well, I think that's unique in the archival record. At least I never come across a call for genocide in such explicit terms. The publication, we'd certainly call it genocide if anybody else were responsible. And this is a call for it. The publication elicited no reaction. That incidentally refutes Dean Koh of the Yale Law School. It is simply taken for granted in the elite intellectual culture that the president and his national security advisor do have the right to order genocide, contrary to Koh's outraged claim. Well, just imagine if the prosecutors at the Milosevic Tribunal could find anything even remotely similar. Well, they'd be overjoyed. You know, trial would be over, several life sentences, death penalty if it adhered to U.S. law. But remember, that's them, not us. And the difference is a core principle of the elite intellectual culture in the West, and in fact, throughout history, rather generally, if you look. The principle of universality is the most elementary of moral truisms. It's the foundation of just war theory and, in fact, of every system of morality, which is why it is repeated over and over again in the Gospels. Rejection of moral truisms is a fundamental principle of intellectual culture, so deeply rooted as to be invisible. And just to illustrate again how deeply entrenched it is, now, that's the world in which we live, incidentally. It's not some exotic thing on Mars. Let's return to the principle of anticipatory self-defense, which is adopted as legitimate by both political organizations in the United States and across virtually the entire spectrum of articulate opinion, that's the usual margins. The principle has some immediate corollaries. So if the United States is granted the right of anticipatory self-defense against terror, then certainly Cuba, Nicaragua, in fact, a long host of others, have been entitled for years to carry out terrorist acts within the United States, because there's no doubt about U.S. involvement in very serious terrorist attacks against them, extensively documented in impeccable sources. In the case of Nicaragua, even condemned by the World Court and the Security Council in two resolutions that the U.S. vetoed, with Britain loyally abstaining. The conclusion that Cuba and Nicaragua, among many others, have long had the right to carry out terrorist atrocities in the U.S., that conclusion is, of course, utterly outrageous and advocated by no one. And thanks to our own self-determined immunity from moral truisms, there's no fear that anyone will draw the outrageous conclusions that follow from our doctrines. And there are actually still more outrageous ones. So I don't know anyone, for example, who goes out in the streets every December 7th to celebrate Pearl Harbor Day by applauding the fascist leaders of Imperial Japan. But by our standards, it's exactly what we should be doing. The bombing of military bases in the U.S. colonies of Hawaii and the Philippines was entirely legitimate and praiseworthy according to our standards. The Japanese leaders knew very well that B-17 Flying Fortresses were coming off the Boeing production lines, and they were surely reading the U.S. press and very familiar with the very public discussions in the United States at the time, explaining how these planes could be used to incinerate Japan's wooden cities in what was called a war of extermination, flying from Hawaiian and Philippine bases. And that's a far more powerful justification for anticipatory self-defense than anything conjured up by Bush and Blair and their associates and supporters. Well, fortunately, we're once again protected from such conclusions by the principled rejection of elementary moral truisms. It's very easy to continue, but too easy, in fact, so I won't go on with some other examples I was going to go into. But that all of this, you know, cite examples at length, it's hard to find an exception. It does leave open a crucial question. How does the great beast react? That is the domestic U.S. counterpart of the second superpower. Well, there's a conventional answer. That is that the population approves of all of this, as was just shown again by the election of George Bush, leading to, what is it, 150,000 people trying to come north. But they're misunderstanding what happened. And as is often the case, a closer look is helpful. So let's take a slightly closer look. The winning candidate last November, early this month, received about 31% of the eligible vote, the loser 29%. The results were very close to what they had been in the year 2000, the same, virtually the same red and blue states, as they're called. A few percentage shift in the vote, which is almost a random event, would have meant that Kerry had won, also telling us nothing about the country and the electorate. The reason is that issues of substance were very consciously kept out of the campaign. You have to remember that political campaigns are designed by the same industries that sell toothpaste and cars and so on. It's not an exaggeration. They're run by the public relations industry. What is their professional concern and their regular vocation? Well, it's not to provide information. Their goal, rather, is deceit. And that's not a secret. Every time you turn on the tube, you see it. Hundreds of billions of dollars a year are spent in what's called advertising, which does not, say, list the properties of next year's cars, as would happen in an unimaginable market society based on what you study in economics courses, informed consumer choice. That's a total myth. Rather, let's take a look at the advertising. It tells you why. The point is not to present information. It's to deceive you. That's why the car, they don't, like GM doesn't tell you, here's what I'm going to produce next year. It takes, you know, 1 minute, no money. What it does is show the car with a, you know, sexy model in it or a sports hero or, you know, doing some ridiculous thing like climbing up a sheer cliff or something like that. And it's some, what it, the point is, and it's true of the whole hundreds of billions of dollars, is to project some kind of an image that might deceive the consumer into buying this car instead of the virtually identical one produced by a competitor. That's the prime commitment of the public relations industry and a way of, one of the many ways of undermining the mythology about markets, which nobody believes in unless you can force them on someone else. And the same is true with elections, which are run by the PR industry. The goal is to project images and to deceive the public into accepting them while sidelining issues for very good reasons, to which I'll come back. And the population knows it. You know, they're not stupid. About 10% of voters say their choice is based on the candidates, reading the polling question, on the candidates' agendas, ideas, platforms, and goals. That's 6% of Kerry voters and 13% of Bush voters, otherwise essentially nobody. The rest rely on what the industry calls qualities and values. So does the candidate project the image of a strong leader, the kind of guy you'd like to meet in a bar, or somebody who cares about you and is just like you? My guess, I have no evidence, but I'm just guessing, is that Bush is very carefully trained to say things like nuclear and misunderestimate and all the other silliness that intellectuals like to ridicule. That's probably about as real as the ranch that was constructed for him and the rest of the whole folksy manor. After all, it would hardly do to present him as a spoiled frat boy from Yale who became rich and powerful because of his rich and powerful connections and family. Rather, the imagery projected has to be a guy just like us, you know, not one of these fancy types, a guy who'll protect us, who cares about us, who shares about our moral values. That's the imagery, which is about as real as in toothpaste ads. Not surprisingly, it's done by the same people. Bush, in that case, the point is to undermine markets. In this case, the point is to undermine democracy. That's the same principle. Bush, if you look, received a large majority among voters who said that they were concerned primarily with moral values and terrorism. Now, as for Bush's moral values, there's an easy way to find out what they are. Read the business press the day after the election. It describes what it called the euphoria in corporate boardrooms and so on. That's not because CEOs are opposed to gay marriage. Actually, most of them are what are called liberals. I mean, their social values are about the same as, you know, Canadian Dimension, probably. If you want to learn more about their moral value, the Bush moral values, just observe the principle, basic principle, which is not concealed. The principle is that costs are to be transferred to your children and your grandchildren. Now, that's environmental costs, fiscal costs, and the rest. It's not concealed, and those are indeed the moral values. The point of the PR industry is to prevent you from seeing anything as obvious as that. What about terror? Well, fact of the matter is that Bush's planners escalated the threat of terror, and pretty consciously. It had been predicted, even by their own intelligence agencies, that would be the consequence of the war in Iraq, and it turned out to be true. And they did it because it's just not a high priority for them, surely as compared with much more serious goals, such as establishing secure military bases in a dependent client state right at the heart of the world's energy resources. Well, you know, that's really important. It's critically important to ensure that the huge profits, one historian of the industry calls them profits beyond the dream of avarice, it's important to ensure that they go into the right pockets, even meaning U.S. energy corporations, and in fact much more than that, the U.S. Treasury, high-tech industry, which is sells weapons and so on, construction corporations and so on, you know, Bechtel and the rest of them. And even more important than the ensuring that the huge profits beyond the dream of avarice go to the right place, certainly not to the people of the region, that's out of the question, but not to competitors either, mostly to the U.S. Much more important than that is the what was called the stupendous strategic importance of the Middle East region back 60 years ago and has been understood ever since, namely having a hand on the spigot guarantees what planners 50 years ago called veto power over others. It's George Kennan, favored it, of course. Just his successor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, wrote a couple of months ago that controlling Iraq gives the United States critical leverage over European and Asian economies. Veto power, in other words. And controlling those rivals has been a major concern of policy planners ever since the Second World War. They are, to quote Henry Kissinger, they're supposed to keep to their regional responsibilities within the overall framework of order managed by the United States. That's what Kissinger instructed Europeans in his Year of Europe address 30 years ago. And sometimes they get out of line, so if so, you can use the critical leverage. That's now much more urgent than it was in the past, as they keep threatening to move in an independent course, maybe even united. So the European Union and China have became each other's leading trading partners last year, and these ties are becoming even tighter. And now includes the world's second largest economy, Japan. So critical leverage is more important than ever for world control in what's sometimes called a tripolar world, three major power centers that has been evolving for 40 years and now much more so. In comparison to this, the threat of terror is a pretty minor consideration, although the threat is known to be awesome. Long before 9/11, it was clearly understood, written about in technical publications, that sooner or later, the jihadist terror that was organized by the U.S. and its allies in the 1980s is likely to combine with weapons of mass destruction, which could have horrifying consequences, but it's just not a high priority. Those who thought they were voting for somebody who's going to protect them from terror and has their moral values are severely deceived. That's the point of advertising and public relations. Well, U.S. public opinion is actually studied with great care and depth, and we know a lot about it. There were major studies released by the most prestigious outfits right before the election, and they showed that people planning to vote for Bush assumed that the Republican Party shared their views, even though the party explicitly rejected them, as was shown. And pretty much the same is true of Kerry supporters. It's modified slightly if you give a very sympathetic interpretation of occasional vague statements that most voters had probably never even heard. The major concerns of Kerry supporters were the economy and health care, and they assumed, falsely as it turns out, that he shared their views on these matters, just as Bush voters assumed falsely that the Republicans shared their views. So, to summarize all this, among those who bothered to vote, they mostly accepted the imagery that was concocted by the PR industry, just as in the non-existent markets that were taught about in economics courses. And the imagery had only the vaguest resemblance to reality. That's, of course, apart from the more wealthy, who do tend to vote their class interests, apparently even more so in 2004 than 2000, which probably accounts for most of the small difference between these 2 years. Well, what about actual public attitudes? That's crucially important, especially for those who want to change the world. Well, again, right before the election, October, major studies were released reporting public attitudes in the United States. And when you look at the results, which are barely reported, you see right away why elections have to keep to deceit, much as in the fake markets that we're taught to revere. Now, here's a couple of examples of public attitudes, virtually quoting from the studies. A considerable majority of the population believe that the United States should accept the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court and the World Court. It's rejected by both parties. That it should sign the Kyoto Protocols. That it should rely on the United Nations to take the lead in international crises, including security, reconstruction, and political transition in Iraq. That's been true for a year and a half. And even a majority believes that the United States should abandon the Security Council veto and follow UN decisions even if it doesn't approve of them. Majority, again, believe that that the U.S. should rely on diplomatic and economic measures more than military ones in the so-called war on terror. And here's a crucial one. The U.S. should use force only if, I'm quoting, there is strong evidence that the country is in imminent danger of being attacked. That means a large majority reject the bipartisan consensus on so-called preemptive war and adopt a rather conventional interpretation of the UN Charter. Overwhelming majorities of the public favor the expansion of purely domestic programs, primarily health care, it's 80%, but also expanded aid to education and expanding Social Security, also like 60-70%. That's been found for years in the same studies carried out by the most reputable organizations that monitor public opinion. In other mainstream polls, 80% favor universal health care. That's something that's also been true for a long time. I mean, the numbers vary depending on exactly how the questions are asked. Occasionally the press discusses this. It says, yeah, everybody seems to want it. But there's a phrase for it. It's called politically impossible. And that's why the New York Times describes how the New York Times has described it in the past. Just again, a couple of days before the election, the New York Times had an article on this, and here's what it said. It says, there is so little political support for government intervention in the health care market in the United States. That's not universal health care, but any government intervention in the health care market. There's so little political support for it that John Kerry took pains in a recent presidential debate to say that his plan for expanding access to health insurance would not create a new government program. That is what the large majority of the population want. But it's politically impossible, and that's correct. It's opposed by the insurance companies, the pharmaceutical industry, and Wall Street, so it's therefore politically impossible in a country where the elite not only doesn't pretend that it's a democracy, but doesn't want it to be. So, like, if 80% of the population wants something, it's politically impossible and has no political support if it's not supported in the places that matter. Well, I could go on with these studies, which are quite interesting, but one interesting thing about them is that they are held by people in virtual isolation. They rarely hear them. They probably regard them as idiosyncratic, like I'm the only person in the country who thinks this. They don't enter into political campaigns. They only enter very marginally into articulate opinion in the media and journals. And the same extends to other domains. And it raises quite important questions about what we call a democratic deficit when we're talking about others. Some of these cases are very revealing. So you remember that last March, Spanish voters voted out a government which had gone to war in opposition to about 90% of the population. Well, when the Spanish government did go to war, joining the U.S. over huge, almost universal objection, it was very highly praised in the United States and Britain and much of the West. Because it was described, as you remember, what was called the New Europe, the hope for the future, the hope for democracy, namely countries that, if you look at the criterion that distinguished the good guys, New Europe, from the bad guys, Old Europe, was very straightforward, almost impossible to miss. It took real dedication to the party line to miss it, and it was universally missed almost. The criterion was if a government takes the same position as the overwhelming majority of the population, it's old Europe, you know, the bad guys, as it doesn't have democratic credentials. That was the term that was actually used. On the other hand, if the government follows the orders from Crawford, Texas, and overrules the vast majority of the population, around 90% in Spain's case, then it's the hope for the democratic future. Tells you a lot about the conception of democracy. Well, last March, Spanish voters voted out that government, and they were bitterly condemned for appeasing terror, and you remember all of that. I didn't see anybody point out that the voters in Spain took almost exactly the same position as about 70% of Americans south of the border. About 70% of people in the United States were in favor of what I just said, transferring authority for reconstruction, security, political transfer in Iraq to the United Nations. In fact, that had been true for about a year at that time. And that's what the Spanish voters voted for. They didn't vote for pulling out the troops. They said leaving them there only under UN authority. Well, there's a difference between Spain and the United States. In Spain, people knew what public opinion was. In the United States, to find it out, you got to do a research project. It's there, but you got to do some work. And in Spain, people could vote for it. In the United States, completely off the electoral agenda. It's really important to keep issues out of the electoral agenda because of popular attitudes. Actually, we could ask... What would the result be if the parties, let's say either of them, had been willing to articulate people's concerns, even on the issues that people pick as most important? Or what would happen if such issues were allowed to enter mainstream discussion? Well, about that we can only speculate, but we do know that it doesn't happen and that the facts are barely even reported. And it seems reasonable to surmise that it's fear of the great beast that lies behind that, and it's pretty deep. Well, the operative conception of democracy is also revealed very clearly in the international arena, as in the case I mentioned and others. Let's take a current case, the death of Yasser Arafat. The lead think piece in the New York Times, by their kind of house lefty intellectual, on the death of Arafat, the lead story think piece said, opened by saying this: the post-Arafat era will be the latest test of a quintessentially American article of faith, that elections provide legitimacy even to the frailest institutions. You read down to the last paragraph on the continuation page, and you read, Washington resisted new national elections among the Palestinians because Arafat would win and gain a fresher mandate, and they might help give credibility and authority to other people the U.S. doesn't like. In other words, democracy is fine if you're sure that the results are going to come out the right way. That's the quintessential faith. And we see that very dramatically right now in the case of Iraq, very dramatically. A year ago, after all the other pretexts had collapsed, Bush's speechwriters came along with a new one to replace them. It's what the liberal press calls the president's messianic vision to bring democracy to Iraq. Middle East, whole world. And the reactions were kind of intriguing. They ranged from rapturous acclaim in the liberal national press, from praise for the it ranged from there to critics. The critics agreed that the vision was noble and inspiring, but they said it might be beyond their reach. The problem is that Iraqi culture is just not ready for such progress towards civilized values. But it was interesting that it was presupposed across the spectrum that this was the goal of the invasion. Well, there's evidence for that, one piece of evidence. Our leader proclaimed it. What more is needed? The critics say, noble vision, but we have to temper the messianic idealism of Bush and Blair with sober realism. Now, that's the London Financial Times, probably the most serious newspaper in the world. Well, actually, there is, you can tell me what the Canadian press said. I'll make a guess, but you can verify it for me. Well, there actually was one sector of opinion that had a different view, Iraqis. At the very same time as the messianic vision was proclaimed in Washington to reverent applause, there was a U.S.-run poll in Baghdad, and it turned out that some people there also believed that that was the goal of the invasion, 1%. A majority of the population took the obvious view. The U.S. invaded Iraq to get control of its resources and to organize the region in U.S. interests, the view you're not allowed to express in the United States, or you're a conspiracy theorist or a Marxist or some other bad word. In fact, Iraqis agree that there's a problem of cultural backwardness that stands in the way of the messianic vision, but they think it's here, not in Iraq. Actually, their views are a little more nuanced if you look. So 1% thought the U.S. invaded to restore establish democracy, but 50% said the U.S. wants democracy in Iraq. Now, that may look like a contradiction until you go on. 50% said the U.S. wants democracy but is going to influence it to ensure that it comes out the right way. In other words, they understand very well the quintessentially American faith, perhaps because it was also the quintessentially British faith, while Britain's boot was on their neck since the First World War. And they don't have to know the history of Wilsonian idealism, as it's called, or Britain's noble counterpart, or the French civilizing mission, or the even more exalted vision of Japanese fascists and many others. It's presumably close to a historical universal. Their own experience is enough. And it's not unusual for those at the wrong end of the club to have a much clearer picture of reality than those who are wielding it. That's true in plenty of domains. Well, at the outset, I mentioned very briefly the very notable successes of popular struggles in the past decades. It's pretty clear if you think about it a little, very rarely discussed for reasons that aren't hard to discern. Both recent history and public attitudes suggest some pretty straightforward and quite conservative strategies for short-term activism on the part of those who don't want to wait for China to save us from ultimate doom. We do enjoy great privilege and freedom, in fact, uniquely so by comparative and historical standards. That legacy was not granted as a gift from above. It was won. It was won by hard and dedicated struggle, which doesn't reduce to pushing a lever every few years. We can, of course, decide to abandon the legacy. You can take the easy way of pessimism. You know, everything's hopeless, so I quit. Or we can make use of that legacy and work to create, in part to recreate, the basis for a functioning democratic culture in which the public plays some role in determining policies, not only in the political arena, from which it's largely excluded, but in the crucial economic arena, from which it is excluded in principle. Now, those are not particularly radical ideas. So, for example, they were articulated very clearly by the leading 20th century social philosopher in the United States, John Dewey, who's American as apple pie in the familiar phrase. He pointed out that until what he called industrial feudalism is replaced by industrial democracy, politics will remain the shadow cast by business over society. Now, Dewey wasn't being particularly original in that. In fact, he was drawing from a long tradition of thought and action that had developed independently in working class culture from the very origins of the Industrial Revolution, actually, right where I live, an area near Boston in the mid-19th century. Those ideas remain just below the surface, and they can become a living part of our societies and our cultures and our institutions. But like other victories for justice and freedom over the centuries, that's not going to happen by itself. One of the clearest lessons of history, including very recent history, is that rights are not granted. They are won. And the rest of it's up to us. Thanks. Thank you.